Chapter 7. "You cannot tell me that the Jedi have records of the Infinite Empire," Jaster says flatly. "The Rakata themselves have no records of their past before their reemergence, and you expect me to believe the Jedi know more? You are talking pseudoscience at best." "It's true," John says, and Jaster can see the smile he tries to hide. Without all that shaggy hair in his face, it's rather harder, particularly when he's flat on his back in the grass. "The Reavan mythologies..." Jaster can't help himself. He scoffs loudly and catches the edge of John's hood, dragging it over his face and then down with a quick tug. The fact that John doesn't flinch, just laughs, makes something warm in Jaster's chest, and he finds that he's smiling despite the absolute nonsense coming out of John's mouth. "Drivel," he says dismissively. "The Reavan mythologies are nothing but adaptations of the Keldroma epics, resurrected for Jedi younglings who can't be bothered to read them without a pantina of propaganda on top." John pushes his hood back, lets it fall to the grass beneath him, and the deep brown shows the true black of his hair more clearly, makes his pale eyes ghost-like. There's a scar that slants down from his forehead across the bridge of his nose, wide and pale against his skin, and Jaster wants to drag his thumb down it, trace it to where it nearly touches the corner of John's mouth, and he almost reaches out. But John is entirely relaxed for the first time Jaster has seen, gone limp in the sun like a cat, and some of the lines of pain and stress have been erased from his face. He doesn't quite look younger, but happy. He looks happy, and Jaster doesn't want to do anything that will disturb that. "There are still planets in the deep core that have ruins from the Infinite Empire," John says, drowsy in the sunlight. His eyes are slipping closed, and he's already relaxed, but Jaster can see him sliding towards sleep. Unsurprising that he would need more of it, after the strain of the day. And the sect that became the Order, they started in the Deep Core too. John is not an uninformed man, it seems. Jaster wonders how he compares to the rest of his Order where knowledge of history is concerned, or if his breadth of understanding is entirely due to his atypical upbringing. "The Jedi Order has been destroyed several times in the history of the Republic," he says pointedly. "Even assuming that such old records survived, and that the Rakata did once rule the known universe, the Infinite Empire collapsed at least 25,000 years ago, several hundred years before the start of the Old Republic, and since then, there have been at least 3 purges." John's snort is soft. "The Jedi exist with the Force," he says, soft. "As long as there is one, there will be the other." Curiously, it doesn't sound like a mantra or even a quote. Jaster pauses, caught off guard by the sudden foray into religion, and considers the phrase for a moment. "And what sage said that?" he asks, bemused. John's eyes flicker open, just long enough to give Jaster a curious glance. "No sage," he says. "No Jedi would need someone to tell them what they already know." Jaster thinks, like a start, of John's words when he was explaining how the Force healing he had attempted left him weak. "Jedi are the Force made physical," he'd said, and Jaster hadn't quite dismissed it as dogma, but maybe he hadn't paid it the attention it was due. "Still," he says, and the words take a little more effort to get out than they should. He feels unnerved, and it's hard to say why. Regardless of the mystical nature of a Force connection, physical records being destroyed, John huffs quietly, head tilting back, and this time Jaster is moving before he can even consider the implications. His fingers stroke through dark hair with a hint of a curl, and it's gratifying how John only twitches for an instant before he looks up at Jaster and smiles. "No one's ever found all the Jedi temples," he says, and his mouth curves, wry. "Not even the Jedi." Jaster can't help but snort at that, twisting a few strands of glossy hair around his fingertips. They're still soft from their washing, and Jaster is reminded of the sight of John, warm and still damp, flushed with the heat. He sets it aside, stroking John's hair with the vague thought of braiding it, but the sun is warm, even as it's fading, and he's feeling a little lazier than he normally might, too. "You had best be referring to sources beyond just the Reavan mythologies," he warns half-heartedly. "They're true," John says, and he turns his head just faintly into Jaster's touch, then seems to remember himself and jerks away. He pushes up. Jaster catches him by the shoulders, careful not to grab, careful not to jar, and guides him back down, shifting until John can pillow his head on his thigh. "Better?" he asks. John glances up at him, and he's wary again, tense to move. It feels like a loss. I've slept too much," he starts. Deliberately, Jaster drags his fingers through John's hair. "You need rest," he says, "and Miles implied that meditation was also necessary, but I managed to distract you from it. Can you manage it lying down?" Slowly, a little gingerly, John shifts, getting an elbow beneath himself and pushing up again. "Better to be sitting," he says, a little rough, and Jaster grimaces but shifts closer, getting an arm behind his back as he sits up. "Support won't disturb these all-important Jedi rituals, will it?" he asks, a little dry, and John quickly shakes his head. "It's just harder when I'm hurt," he says carefully, "and better to do it like I was taught." "To help with concentration, likely." It makes sense, and Jaster hums in quiet assent, sliding his arm up a little to brace John more easily. John grimaces a little as he comes straight, hand going to his stomach, but after a bare instant he moves it away, folding his hands together instead. One hand cupping the other, thumbs touching, Jaster thinks, cataloging the pose with a glance. He's never seen a Jedi meditate in real life before, and the explanations of the position and the meanings behind them are all but non-existent in what literature he's been able to find. He files his first roster of questions away to ask later, when John isn't actively in the middle of his practice. As Jaster watches, feels through the arm around John's back, John's breaths are deepening, evening out. There's nothing flashy, nothing obvious about whatever sort of connection to the Force this provides. Just stillness and quiet and peace. Jaster might mistake John for a statue if he came across him like this without warning, if a lovely one. It's a little odd, though, to be reminded so clearly that the Jedi are monks for all intents and purposes. Diplomats, peacekeepers, watchers, but a religious order that the Republic forged ties with for fear of their power. An attempt to keep the Jedi under control, by some accountings, and keep them where the Republic could use them. But more than that, Jaster thinks, stroking a thumb over the soft cloth covering John's hip. Like Mandalorians are more than the sum of their wars, the Jedi are more than the sum of their service. A good thing to remember in the context of marrying one. Still, it's a peaceful evening, and Jaster can think of worse things than sitting out in the sunset. He'd forgotten what they looked like on Concord Dawn, their particular brilliance in this atmosphere, and the reminder is a good one. He lets himself relax and lets his mind drift, and doesn't think about the piles of work still awaiting him in his office. He has a wedding coming up. Surely that's reason enough to take a small vacation, even if it's only for a few hours. A little amused at himself, Jaster shifts, leaning back on one hand, the other arm still firmly wrapped around John. It's incredibly odd to think that in a handful of days he'll be a married man, even if this is his own scheme. He's never truly considered marrying before. He adopted Jango when he was young, and then found Arla a few years later, and between raising the two of them and the true Mandalorians in the Civil War, he's hardly had time for a steady relationship, let alone a spouse. His mother wasn't married either, and had no interest in such things. She wanted a child, so she found an orphan, raised Jaster, and passed on all her skills. It was good, and not something Jaster would ever want changed, but his passing impressions of marriage are probably woefully inaccurate, he thinks ruefully, watching a flight of birds wing across the sun-stained clouds. It's not an impossible thing to overcome. It's likely not even very important that Jaster has never married and doesn't know all the pitfalls, given that he's marrying a Jedi who culturally has no concept of the ritual, and who will likely be gone more often than not on whatever missions his order assigns him. Still, the not knowing itches and Something heavy settles on his shoulder, and Jaster blinks, glancing down to find John's head resting against his chest, eyes closed. He's very clearly asleep. A quiet laugh shakes loose from his chest, and Jaster loosens his grip, reaches up to brush John's hair out of his face, and tuck the soft strands back behind his ear. "I'm fairly sure," he says softly, "that this isn't part of a usual meditation routine, Jedi." There's no answer from John, just quiet breaths against Jaster's shirt, the warm slump of his body. Too much movement, Jaster thinks, and doesn't move, just lets John sleep against his side. Too much worry, potentially. Miles can dress up his concern as wanting John to see the river all he likes, but Jaster's known him since they were both teenagers, and he knows how to read Miles. All of Miles' concerns about the security are founded in experience, given the Death Watch's tactics. And while Jaster isn't entirely sure what Miles asked John to do, it's likely related. Jaster didn't mean this to strain John or Miles, but... well, there's every chance Jaster is feeling a little desperate after Montross almost killed Django again. Too many attacks, too much suffering, and the fact that Django survived is down to Arla's quick thinking and speed with a jetpack. "Well, this is cute," Arla says from behind him, and Jaster tips his head back as her shadow falls over him, then reaches out, patting the bank beside him. "I'm afraid that between the two of us and Miles, we wore him out," he says a little dryly, and Arla snorts, eyes sweeping over John for an instant before she takes a seat on the grass, leaning back on her hands and stretching her legs out. The black and white of her armor is an eerie thing in the fading light, making her a ghost, a shadow, a bad dream. Jaster never would have argued with her about the choice of colors, but he'd had reservations about her decisions, certainly. "Maybe next time he'll be worn out for better reasons," Arla says, and before Jaster can even narrow his eyes at her, wondering if that's meant to be the innuendo it sounded like, she adds, "reasons that don't have to do with the Death Watch. A few of Miles' flunkies are looking into the information he gave us, and it seems solid so far." "I hardly think it would have been false," Jaster says mildly, but Arla just tips one shoulder in a shrug. She doesn't trust easily, and Jaster knows that it will take something truly impressive for her to accept John at his word. She has her reasons for it, and Jaster will never try to argue her out of them, regardless of his own faith in John's lack of intent to do harm. "Countess Wren accepted your invitation," she says instead. "Clan Saxon sent a messenger to Cronest, and they weren't shot out of the air, so that's a good start. Ursa said she intended to come with two guards and no other guests." "Well, easier to watch than a force of commandos," Jaster says optimistically, carefully resettling John when he realizes John is starting to slide. "She's currently 15? A bold move for her to take my offer so readily." Arla snorts, but the curve of her mouth is rueful. "You do appreciate children being bold," she says dryly, "especially when there's a chance they're going to stab you in the throat." Jaster smiles, and when she leans in, he presses their temples together, lays his hand over hers. "It seems to be turning out well for me so far," he says, "given my track record." "Old man," Arla says fondly, and shoves him lightly as she sits up. "Have you gotten him to hand over his library pass yet, or do I need to hold him still while you beat him up for it?" "It's an archive," Jaster says, exasperated, but when he reaches out to swat at her, she ducks away with a laugh. "And there will be no beating anyone up. I will approach the harpy reasonably, when the time is appropriate. So 5 minutes after the ink dries on your marriage certificate," Arla laughs. She flops back before Jaster can get revenge, stretching her arms over her head, and hums lightly. "If Tor crashes the party, he's mine." "Of course," Jaster says quietly, because despite all the pain Tor Vizsla has caused the true Mandalorians as a whole, he's never argued with Arla's claim to his death. She was the one most grievously abused by him personally, and she's made it her personal quest to execute him for it, which Jaster will never deny her. Though Tor is a coward in his bones, I doubt he'll show his face with so many enemies at hand. Arla makes a sound of disgusted agreement. "If something happens, I think Miles is going to go gray all at once," she says, and casts a careful look at John, lashes veiling her gaze for an instant before her eyes flicker toward the lone hawk dipping over the river. We don't have enough people. Jester breathes out a sigh. He's well aware of that fact. Their ranks are stretched thin, trying to defend all the settlements and colonies, and the Death Watch hits hard and fast and favors sabotage and terrorist tactics. It's hard for anyone to mount a credible offensive effort when they're so busy trying to put out fires they can hardly keep up. Too many clans are staying neutral, he says tiredly, and Arla, at least, won't think he's any weaker for the exhaustion that's been weighing at him for months now. Since Montross first betrayed him, and Jaster had realized with a bleak sort of shock that even the things he thought were safe and sacred weren't anymore. Marrying the Jedi will help with that, Arla says, bland. When Jaster slants her a glance, she arches a brow right back at him and says, I'm surprised you want the Republic weighing in on the war, and if you tie yourself to their peacekeepers, they will weigh in. Jaster snorts. It will be good for the old cowards in the Senate, he says dismissively. If they're forced to acknowledge a side, it will be ours. No one in their right mind would support Tor and his terrorists over an actual government. Then we'll be able to send a senator of our own and request aid. Food, at the very least. Arla doesn't look entirely convinced. If you're not careful, they'll just acknowledge the new Mandalorians and leave us and the Death Watch to burn each other out, she says bitterly. No. Jaster says, quiet but certain. The clans would never stand for that. Getting rid of our heritage? Whether you're Death Watch or true Mandalorian, there's no way you could accept that. The Senate is mired in idiocy, but that, at least, is clear to anyone with a modicum of sense. Something in the set of Arla's shoulders eases. That's true, she says, rueful. And who would they even pick on Kalevala? The Duke? His 12-year-old daughter? Tor's son, Jaster suggests, mostly for the face Arla pulls. The only time she met Prey, she tried to strangle him with her bare hands, and Jaster can't entirely say he disapproves of the instinct. Prey's supposedly forsworn his father's violent ways, gone to live with family on Kalevala, and Jaster isn't one to doubt a teenager's word, but... Well, Prey takes after Tor a little too much for Jaster's comfort. Or Arla's, clearly. I'd stage a coup if that happened, Arla says disgustedly. Jaster hums. Technically, Prey is in line to inherit the Darksaber, he points out, and the weapon was stolen from the Jedi centuries ago, has managed to become a symbol of Mandalore's leader. Jaster might not agree, but he understands the historical significance of such a thing. And it's a shame, objectively, that a brute like Tor carries an artifact once owned by Tar Vizsla, one of Mandalore's greatest warriors. Arla's sound of disgust is even louder and more heartfelt this time. If we could get the Darksaber, I bet Tor would lose half his support overnight, she says, fierce. All of those traditionalists following him because he's holding it, they'd rather be following you, but they're cowards. Hidebound, Jaster corrects dryly, but she has a point. Tor has the Darksaber so well hidden that Jaster has never seen it, so there's little hope of finding it. But if he could get his hands on it, Arla's likely correct about what would happen to Tor's base of support. Jaster knows full well that most of them hate Tor's belief that Mandalorians are the rightful rulers of the galaxy, and his insistence on using underhanded, contemptible tactics, but they're so blinded by belief in his right to rule that they won't say anything. Sighing, he shifts his arm around John, tugs him into a slightly more comfortable position. John huffs a little, curling in, and one of his scarred hands comes up, tangling in Jaster's shirt as he tucks his head into the curve of Jaster's throat like he's seeking body heat. Like this morning, when he seemed entirely unbothered by Jaster on top of him, like the times he's almost leaned into Jaster's touches and... Well, it's appealing. Jaster is self-aware enough to admit that, coupled with the image of John right after his shower, or the memory of broad shoulders beneath him, the way John shifted back into the curve of Jaster's body with an instinctive sort of want, it's enough to make anyone with an interest in sex think indecent things. Natural. John is handsome, and Jaster is attracted. That doesn't mean he'll act on it. Well, he says, forcing his thoughts away from the Jedi in his arms. The support of the Jedi Order, and by proxy the Senate, will help us convince some of the less traditional clans that we don't intend to repeat the mistakes of the past and launch an attempt to conquer known space. That should earn us a few more allies, if we're clever about it. Arla grins at him like a Tuca in the cream. You should make Miles our new senator, she says. His face will be amazing. I want to watch him have a crisis over it, please. Jaster can't help it. He laughs, reaching over to scrub a hand through her messy braid and destroy it completely as she hisses in indignation, swatting and swiping at him. If I make Miles the Mandalorian senator, you can be the one to tell him, he promises, and Arla thumps him in the ribs, but she's grinning the whole time. John wakes without any memory of having gone to sleep, limbs heavy and head fuzzy, to the sound of shouting in the distance. Practically on top of him, there's a low groan, and Jaster buries his face between John's shoulder blades, arms tightening around his chest. John almost startles as the heat and breadth and warmth of him registers, the brush of stubble, the drag of fingers over his side leaving lines of fire in their wake, and his heart trips into a frantic pace. And then, Jaster heaves himself up and is gone, leaving a whirl of cold air to take his place as he crosses to the door in nothing but low-slung sleep pants, grabbing a blaster off the wall as he goes. John can't feel any foreign minds nearby, but there's a wash of confusion and alarm even so, and he carefully rolls over and sits up, pulling the blankets around him. Even as he does, the door chimes, and Jaster has it open before the sound even fades, almost crashing into Miles as he takes a half step forward. Miles, Jaster says sharply, and Miles nods, in full armor with his helmet tucked under his arm. Sir, he answers. Jango's disappeared. John can feel the lurch in Jaster, the way his breath catches and fear surges. The camera's in the medical wing, he starts. Miles shakes his head. Disabled, and both the medical droids were taken offline. Fear settles into dread, desperate hope, determination. Whoever took him can't have gotten far, Jaster says grimly. Arla? Fine. She's organizing a search of the surrounding spaceports. Miles steps back, pulling his helmet on, and hands Jaster a much newer blaster. Get a group to sweep the house as well. If this was the Death Watch, they'll have planted at least one bomb somewhere, Jaster says grimly. He drops the old blaster on a chest and grabs a coat off its hook, then turns, casting a look back at John. He hesitates, then says, Stay here, John. I'll lock the door to keep anyone out. John opens his mouth to protest, then stops. Considers how he feels, the fact that quick movements likely aren't going to be possible right now, and closes it. Nods instead, and Jaster's flicker of relief is clear. Thank you, he says, and then is gone, the door sliding shut behind him with a thump of engaging locks. John can hear his voice immediately rise, Miles's rapid footsteps heading in the other direction, but there's no sense of alarm in the Force, even if it's everywhere else in the compound. John trusts his instincts over everything, his connection to the Force even more so, and he considers it for a moment, the calm of it, the still pre-dawn outside the window. If something did happen, he can't sense it anywhere, or any trace of the ill intent that would mark it. Instead, the world seems quiet outside of the frantic rush currently taking place. John weighs his soreness for a moment, then carefully slides out of bed. He must have fallen asleep at the river and then slept all the way through until dawn, and he feels better for it. Movement is easier, and the ache of exhaustion isn't carved into his bones quite so deeply anymore. When he takes a step, it's not as steady as he would like, but he doesn't feel like he's about to collapse at the foot of the bed either. He hasn't met Jango yet, only knows him by reputation as the Mandalore's son. Knows, too, that it's possible to take anyone by surprise in the right situation, but... Gingerly, John pulls on his clothes, then loosely belts the tunic and grabs his cloak, carefully hauling it up over his shoulders. His lightsaber is with the remnants of his old clothes, and he pauses, but finally decides to take it, sliding it up his sleeve instead of through his sash like he normally would, to keep from accidentally jarring anything if something is wrong and he has to go for it quickly. There's no one outside the door. The search seems to be spread out through the house or heading out into the areas beyond the river. John spends a moment assessing where Jaster is, then turns, pushes open the glass doors leading out, and slips down the steps. It's slow going, and every step has to be careful, but he's moving at the very least. Moving, following the faint tug of the force towards the edge of the garden, and John breathes out, lets whatever edge of tension was leached from Jaster and Miles bleed out into the force around him. There's nothing but calm in the pre-dawn air, and John keeps walking. End of chapter 7.